Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. Hello there.
Yes.
Yes, I can.
All right. I would like to welcome everyone to Voices of Wisdom. This is our Tribe Family Radio talk show that is initiated by the Tribe Gumbo for the Soul a radio show with our director and supporter, Miss Beverly Black. We will give you some more information about what and who we are as we move along with the program. Today, we are so blessed to be able to have as our guest Senator Barbara A. Robinson, and we are going to introduce her in just a moment. I am, as you probably may know, a part of the Tugulu Nine, and we are a group that integrated, or rather desegregated, the library in Jackson, Mississippi, back in 1961. We have been continuing to tell our story through many avenues, and today we get a chance to see about another lady who has been making her story about people and progress. Right now, I'm going to let Mr. Joseph Jackson tell you about himself a minute or two, and then we'll come back with our introduction of Senator Barbara A. Robinson. You have it, Joseph.
Thanks, Geraldine Hollis, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis. I am Joseph Jackson, Jr., a native of Memphis, Tennessee, and I grew up under the segregated laws of Jim Crow, and I have always have been about making a difference for my people. And that meant me becoming an ordained minister and choosing to follow in the footsteps of Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, who was the president of Morehouse College, who was a great influence upon another great civil rights leader. His name is Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and that was how I ended up at Tougaloo Southern Christian College, one of the historical black colleges and universities. And I'm just proud to really be honored to have Senator Barbara Robinson as our guest. And I'm just excited to hear what she has to say about the present state of affairs of our country. And that's about all I can say right now. Back to you.
Well said. Right now, Senator Barbara Robinson, it has been a pleasure just to read your information. When I read it all, I said to myself, what an awesome lady. I know that I'm going to let you introduce yourself, but I wanted to pre-introduce you because you have accomplished so much in your life, and not only accomplished it, but you made it something that could be rewarding for many people. So we want to let them know as we go through our today's program. It's going to be a conversational program. And in that way, we will get a chance to interact, to support, to give some more information. And to be able to let this program be something that people can leave with a lot of self-appreciation, because they too may have some of the same ideologies that we have had, or some of the same challenges that we have had, and to know that they too can overcome them. So at this time, I'm going to just start the program with, who is Barbara A. Robinson? You got the floor.
Is that question posed to me?
Yes, ma'am. This is to open the door. Who is Barbara A. Robinson?
Wow. Hello, everybody. And Mr. Joseph Jackson, do you know someone in Memphis, Tennessee, by the name of Mary Wright? She's one of the trailblazers there. Okay, you said Memphis, Tennessee, and I had done some work there. As a matter of fact, one of my blessings was that I received a key to the city from three places, and Memphis, Tennessee was one of the places. And I had gone there to do some training for community organizations. And I was brought there. It was an organization called SMAC, Students and Mothers Against Crime, or something like that. But it's been some time ago.
Well, Senator Pumpkin, but Senator Robinson, I do not know of the lady that you've mentioned, Mrs. Wright, but I heard you on a previous radio show, and the narrator was Mrs. Daisy Brown, and the host of this program sent me a link of that program, and I was just really, after listening to you and listening about your accomplishments and your earlier years there, growing up, I think your home town was in Georgia, but you kept saying Alabama also.
Both of them, actually. I was born in Alabama, and I went to high school in Georgia. And every year, as soon as school was out during the summer, I went back home. And back home was Alabama.
And that was Columbus, Alabama?
No, Columbus, Georgia.
Okay.
And this was Alexander City, Alabama.
Oh, okay. Well, my point is that, you know, I heard you mention that you have traveled, you know, to several cities training others, you know, regarding what you do so well. And you mentioned Tennessee, and that said, oh, she's been to my state. Okay.
Yeah,
so,
I've been here several times.
Was that Memphis, Tennessee, or was it Nashville?
Well, it was both. It was Memphis, Tennessee. I was in Nashville, Tennessee with the Black Enterprise. I had flown me there for training in Nashville. But I was in Memphis, Tennessee several times doing training and book signing. On a book signing tour, and I had also there conducting a seminar on leadership development. So I've been to Memphis several times, and I was also a speaker at one of the churches there. I don't remember which one. I have it written down somewhere, but I was a Women's Day speaker at one of the churches there. So I've been a little bit. I'm glad to, you know, when we talk about people, I mean, when I get into a conversation with people, when they say I was born during the Jim Crow era, I say, yeah, I know my kind of folks is. Because I can't identify, because I remember, you know, not being able to go to the restrooms, and as I've said so many times before, the restrooms were, some of them said male, female, and some said ladies, gentlemen. But when it got to us, it just said colored. So we weren't male, female, we weren't ladies or gentlemen, we were just colored. And it was all thrown in there together. And the many times that I could not eat at the counter, and in my first book I talk about how I challenged the my mother used to always think that I was going to get hurt because I would challenge the white drivers when they wanted me to move to the back of the bus, and I wouldn't do, or I'd go to a white church and they want to put me out, and my girlfriend and I, and we were in high school then. You know, so I guess they've always called me a rebel. And when I got here in Baltimore and integrated the restrooms in the court system, and also started black women being able to wear the natural hairstyle in the court system, and also women being able to wear slacks to work in the court system. I put them in my car and headed for Annapolis to fight for the rights for women to wear slacks. And then when, you know, they kept promoting people who did not look like me and kept saying that they couldn't find any qualified blacks, then I developed a program to train people to be qualified blacks so they couldn't say that they couldn't find any qualified blacks for court reporters because I gave them some. And so, you know, they called me militant and all that other stuff. So when, and this was at the court system during the time when the system was not very kind to people of color, and especially women who didn't know their place, as they said, I didn't know my place. And I figured my place was wherever I wanted it to be. So I was an at-will employee, which meant that the 23 judges could fire me at will. I didn't have to go through a merit system. So when one of the judges told me to either resign or he would fire me, I told him to put that in writing. And he did. And I took that letter and I put it in my desk drawer and I went to Africa. And I did some training there. And while in Africa, I, you know, God said, it's time for you to do your own thing, sweetheart. I got something else for you to do. So when I came back, I started a company in the basement of my home. And those judges tried to stop me because I started the company on an unemployment check. And they tried to stop me and said that I should be looking for a job. And I challenged them. You know, I still had that letter in my drawer. And I said, you know, if y'all leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. Otherwise, I'll go to the media and I will sing, you know, because I know where the bodies are buried in the court system. So they left me alone, and I started a company and in my basement, as I said, and I grew that company into a multi-million-dollar corporation with 162 people on my payroll. And you know, and bought several properties, et cetera. And I was in business for almost 30 years until my husband passed, and I decided that my next step was to fight for black businesses, especially women-owned businesses. So that's when I joined the race for a seat in the House of Delegates. There were 9 folks running, and everybody was younger and more experienced than me, but that never did stop me. So I jumped in the race and won, and I was in the House of Delegates for 10 years fighting for minority business, and I won some really, really major challenges, some major bills for women business owners and minority business owners. I just didn't think that there was anybody in Annapolis that knew more about black business than I did. They may know as much, but I didn't think anybody knew more. And I knew that there was nobody there that had gone through the challenges that I had trying to become a successful woman business owner. So I took them on, and for 12 years, built up small businesses. In one, I brought back $800 million that the government was sending over to nonprofits. When they said that a nonprofit company is a minority business, and it's not. So when I went to the Board of Estimates and stood before them as the only black woman standing up there defending it, it took me 5 years, but I finally got that law to pass. So
right here, we're going to give you a break. You've been talking so, and I know that you have so much to interject into this. And when I ask you, who is Senator Barbara A. Robinson? You gave us more than just an introduction, and we are still just trying to digest some of this. I just wanted to pull us back to the format here that we have, and we ask, who is Barbara A. Robinson? We know now that you are about people and progress. You have already said that. Not only said it, you demonstrated it. And what it is, you also introduced us to the fact that you were dealing with politics and power. And for the listeners here, we have some young people on. We have some young business people on. We have people that may want to be in this type of a situation where they can command some things for themselves. And so you let it be known that you are not about just politics and power. You are about helping and enlightening. And basically that's what I'm about, to enlighten, to get people to know what the possibilities are for them. So right now we know that you had a lot of education and training. You've made a lot of accomplishments, and you just shared with us about your employment history, and that's all good. And also, we're getting into the next phase, which you probably are already were ready to get to us, and that was some of your professional affiliations that you had to deal with in order to get to the place where you were. I really like the part that you mentioned, that you went to Africa. We find that there are a lot of people now that are getting an opportunity to go to Africa, and they are seeing that they too can lend a hand and do some things that they can do in that country, and also maybe bring some things back from there, because the people are hungry over there. Mm-hmm. They're not just hungry for food. They're hungry for to be able to integrate into where we are. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can just pull that in to what we are talking about on this next phase. And thank you, Joseph, for keeping that conversation going, and just pick up on these special clues that Ms. Robinson is telling us and see where we can go with this even deeper. So,
well, Joseph, partner, when you sent that link, I really, when I heard about Senator Robinson's accomplishments and knowing that, she grew up in the South, and when she mentioned that when she grew up, the street that she lived on were not paved streets, and they did not have hot water, and then just by the mere fact that she's from the South and we're from the South, I knew I was going to have a outstanding conversation with Ms. Robinson.
Yes.
Because like she said on that previous program, she told Mr. Cooper and Mr. Helinski, she called them homeboys. Well, Senator Robinson, you are definitely a homegirl.
I love it.
Yes. With that note, Senator, before you start, I just wanted to share with you that for my introduction into why I was a part of the Tougaloo Nine, I experienced some of those same things, and I want you to know that I was that type of a young lady too. They mm-hmm. knew that I was a rebel. I had to be. And just for to add a little more clarity to this, I happened to be the firstborn in a family of which ended up with my mom being six of us. There were five boys behind me, and I was a girl and the oldest. And that meant that I learned how to be up. Well, anyway, I learned how to move forward. And I lived on those same type of places that you did. I didn't even know how to talk with a white person. I didn't have any streets to walk on, the sidewalks. That's my story. Sidewalks are the key things that got me moving forward, because I didn't see sidewalks unless they were in the white neighborhood. And I'm like,
that's
why?
That's right.
Why?
That's absolutely
why can't I skate in my neighborhood with my skates on? I can't skate on no gravel.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And we had to go in the white section in order to skate until
That's
they
right.
would put us off. You know, we were making too much noise, but we had to go in the white folks section in order to skate. We used to call it the tar road. We go up on the tar road and skate. Yeah. You know, there was also a time we went barefoot, too.
Oh, I didn't wear any shoes all summer, unless I was going to church.
You take a bath and you put on clean clothes, and what you put on today, that's what you put on tomorrow, until
that's
you
right.
took a bath that afternoon, but you were still
that
barefoot.
Absolutely. We came from the same neighborhood, just different streets. Just different states, but the
Absolutely.
State of where we were was the same. We were trying to get to move forward,
mm-hmm.
and there were people that didn't want us to move forward, but we were determined. And I know that you said that, and we have tried to be able to let people know that's what it's all about. And today, even so, we know that there are so many people, they need to know that they too can move forward.
You know, one of the bills, you mentioned the library, one of the bills that I fought for 2 years, and I got that passed, and that was to put more money into one of my bills. I got $3 million, and I was fighting for more to keep the libraries open in certain neighborhoods, because in certain neighborhoods, the only way that people, especially African Americans, would be able to use computers would be in the libraries. And when they close libraries up around 3 or 4 o'clock, when seniors, especially older adults, are getting off from work, they never get a chance to use the library. And I know how important it was to me growing up. And I also know where, and growing up in Alabama, it was the only library that was open for me was in the projects. And that closed on Saturdays and Sundays. So I had to actually struggle to get what I needed during the week. So I understood exactly how people feel when they aren't able to use the library. And so that was one of the reasons, or the main reason, that I fought for the money to keep the library open. And it was just so interesting that so many people want to know, why was that important?
Oh, yes. Good question, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Good question. Why was that important?
Why was that important? And that was the reason that I just explained, you know, because the only time that people were able to use it was doing after work on Saturdays or Sunday when they were not at work. You know, and that was mostly in sections, African-American sections. You find libraries in the white section are staying open
uh-huh.
longer, but in the black section they were not. They call it the disadvantaged section, well, you're going to keep a person to maintaining that disadvantaged qualification or disadvantaged status as long as they aren't able to feed their mind. And if you keep taking away something in order to feed their mind, they're going to always stay where they are. So that was one of the main reasons that I was fighting. You know, we have so many minds, great minds out here for these young people. Just they don't have access to knowledge. And some of them are thirsting for knowledge.
I think that's what they're looking for. They're looking for some real knowledge. So
that's
they
right.
end up getting untruth.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
I in my area I signed what was called a big measure, and it was called Measure M, and it was actually to add monies and time to the library system here in my area, and I was one of the signers that signed on to this measure to put my name to it to make
mm-hmm.
sure that I would be able to help and assist in getting this passed. Libraries were closed on Saturdays. They closed
mm-hmm.
at a time that you were speaking up now. And
mm-hmm.
It was a very big disadvantage to the people who needed them and also wanted them.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm taking a breath in, I just wanted to let you know while I'm breathing out that the Tugulu Nine went into the library in Jackson, Mississippi, because it was a public facility. And it was maintained by public taxes. Even though we were black, we still had to pay taxes like any
right.
other citizen. So we were being denied, and that was, Megger didn't really want us to do something that was frivolous. We thought about doing something that would have made an impact, a great impact in the community. And so this is what we did, and I appreciate you catching on and latching on to that word library, because we are continuing to seek and say things about what we need for our libraries. Our promoter, Miss Beverly Robinson, has an awesome story about her life in the library. And
mm-hmm.
If we don't watch it, she might even break in and tell us about her experience with the library, because she is so adamant and with good reasons, because at that time that was what carried her over to be able to move where she is today, the library. So we have to continue to speak on things like this that are so important, because people now, they take everything to be credible but the things that are reality. You have our young children who do not have a book in the home, but they have everything else. They can go online and do these things, but they don't know how to cherish a book. They don't know how to pick that book up and put their hands around it and live within those words and be able to move forward with that. So I continue. Every time I speak, I'm more than likely speaking at a library or school or organization and telling them, because reading is still so important.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Senator Robinson, I am very, very curious as to, number one, why did you feel the need or the urge or the motivation to go to Africa, and at what time did you go to Africa, and what African city did you attend? Those are some loaded questions.
I went to Lusaka, Zambia.
Okay.
And I was there in 87, and I was there again in 89. When I went there as a missionary from my church, and I had gone over there to actually see what we had been corresponding with women there, and there was a women group over there. We had been corresponding through my missionary that they wanted to learn how to start their business. They had stood with the men and helped build a hospital, but they were looked at in Zambia at that time as second-class citizens, and they wanted to know how to start a business. So I had met with some of the men leaders from Zambia, had come to Baltimore, and they were in a meeting at Bethel AME, which was my church. And they were saying, you know, when they met with me, they were saying that women should stay at home and cook and et cetera, et cetera. So then one of the men said, well, they might listen to you because as an American lady, you will not be put in the same category as the Zambian women. So I said that, you know, I would go over and see what they needed and come back and put together a training program to teach the women. So while I'm there, I'm speaking to must have been about 40 women or so, and I listened to, you know, what they said, and I said, you know, I'm writing notes, and I said, I will, you know, come back and teach you. And one lady who seemed to be the older one in the group and the one that was speaking for the group, she says, that is not what you said, my sister. You said you would teach us. And I said, okay, yeah, I will teach you, but I'm going back to America. No, that is not what you said. You said you would come here and teach us. You said nothing about going back to America to learn. I said, but I didn't bring, I brought no books. I brought absolutely, that is not what you said. That is your problem. You said you would teach us. And so I said, okay, well, when do you want me to teach you? Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we will be here. So I had to go back, and I was living with a family there. So I went back, and I just got on my knees, and I said, Father, you sent me here. Now you got to help me out of this. I have no clue what you want me to do, God, but you got to work with me. So I put together from experience. I had brought no books with me. I put together from experience what I had done, you know, and what I had learned and et cetera, et cetera. And it turned into one of the most powerful sessions that I have ever experienced. For 5 days we were there, and we were in a school that it was a dirt floor. There was no light. We were reading by candlelight because as soon as it started getting dark, they didn't let me go. We were using by candlelight. And the blackboard that we were using, the chalk, was almost like it was almost like powder. You know, when I would write on the board, it kept falling apart. So we were writing on the board, and then we were writing on the ground. But it turned into a powerful, powerful session. And then when I came back to America and then went back again, I was just so glad to see that the women had actually started their business. They had turned their hobby, like there was a lot of construction going on. So one of the women, I was saying, people say, look at what you're good in. I said, no, look at what you like to do, and you'll get good at it. And so this one woman liked to cook, and she started this company of taking food to construction sites to feed the construction workers every day at a certain time. You know,
awesome.
And just so many, like in basket weaving and how to market your ware, how to promote yourself, and how to keep records. Financial records, and it was just an extremely rewarding experience.
Wow.
I'm glad that Joseph redirected you to that because that is just powerful. And as I'm talking, I'm thinking about some of the young people that we are dealing with that are starting businesses, and even in the family, we need to have those kind of things heard. So you have so much to share.
One of the bills that I put in this year, it didn't pass, but I have a friend I'm going to keep pushing that bill, and that's to teach financial literacy and entrepreneurship in high schools beginning at grade 10, and also teach financial literacy and entrepreneurship in prison for inmates who are within a year of being released. I taught in prison for 7 years, and I see –
Oh, my God.
You know, the mindset of what people can do. And we can reduce the recidivism rate by teaching individuals to start business so that they do not have to commit crime to go back. You know, I got a painting that's hanging in my basement right now that was painted by an inmate who's doing life that didn't know he could paint until he was incarcerated.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Then he found himself.
Absolutely.
He didn't have the opportunity to find himself before that.
Absolutely.
Wow.
You know,
what you're doing, you're opening up opportunities for young people. I have this down in our program of direction here because I know we can go left and right and in a circle because Joseph and I, we talk all of the time. Everybody may not know that, but we talk all of the time. So,
well, they know you, Ms. Hollis, the public knows it now.
Okay. Okay. The application you have here, the application of your legislative priorities, and you had some reasons here why you were elected for a third time, not just two, but a third time. And in those things that I pointed out that you wrote about is that one of the things was the economic empowerment and business development. So you were moving forward in a way that, and you still are, that really helps the community and our people.
Absolutely.
And there are just so many other things that you are doing that you have started. And this is one of the reasons why we want to commend you and to encourage you to continue to tell your story, because it's not just your story. It is our story, too.
Absolutely.
Right.
And not only that, but you are a woman of achievement. You've said that, and we have been able to read that. And you also are concerned about the quality of life enhancement. And just for you to bring out the prison and the kinds of things that you're doing, the things that you did in Africa, you are already working with the quality of life enhancement. And I would love to be able to, if everybody's not on this link, to be able to let them know, go back there and listen to this, because there is a piece of information that can really help you. Also, the next thing is the education, and we see that you're doing that. And not only that, you're doing it now to encourage others, but that you had an educational trailway for yourself. Could you just reach back and tell us a little bit about that? Because I think this will help a lot of other people, too, because they don't realize if they get out of school and they don't get a chance to do all of the things they want to do right then, they feel as though I'm not ready for it, or maybe I'm a failure. Could you just go back to that part for us?
Yeah, it took me 18 years to get my undergraduate degree. When I came from Georgia during the time when it took 2 days to get here on the train because it stopped at every little place between Georgia and Maryland. So I talk a lot about that. I talk about, in my first book, And Still I Cry, I talk about the suitcase that I got out of a trash can in order to use, and how I bought men neckties and tied it around the suitcase to keep it closed, and it was so raggedy that the conductor took it down and hid. So when I got to Baltimore, first time being away from home, alone, and I was just so glad because by that time my stepfather, who physically and sexually abused me, was in jail, and my mother was an alcoholic, but she was a beautiful woman, a beautiful personality when she was sober. And so when I got to Baltimore, I didn't wait for them to send me a permit to register. I didn't know that I needed that. So that meant that there was no room for me to live on campus. So I had to move off what they call an approved home. And I moved off campus, which isolated me actually from the people on campus because I knew absolutely nobody in Baltimore. Just so happened that one of my homeroom teachers from Georgia was there teaching home economics, Miss Pendleton. Never will forget her. She taught me in the ninth grade. So she gave me $3 because I only had $1 when I got to Baltimore. Actually, I had a dime when I got to Morgan. And so she gave me, and this was on a Friday, so she gave me $3, and she laid $3 on the bed because I'm laying on bed in this room crying because they were getting ready to send me off campus to someplace in Baltimore. And I had to go back to get that raggedy suitcase, and I used that money to go back to do it. And so I was in college there for a while, and I got pregnant. Dropped out of school because I couldn't go to school not being married and pregnant. And I ended up marrying the man who became my husband and the father of my children. But by the time I did get married, I was already pregnant again with triplets.
I don't know how much more of her story I can accept because I don't want to cry tonight.
We are just continuing to be amazed. Just keep listening. We're still on education, Joseph. We're still on education.
So I had to drop out of school. Well, I couldn't go back to school, actually, because now I got these four babies I got to take care of. So and then I got in the streets. I started hanging around with a crowd of people, and I started doing drugs and drinking and hanging out and doing a whole lot of other stuff. And that went on, and I started working in factories. And then one time I had a job standing on street corners, handed out pamphlets. Then I got a job again at some white folks' house, and that went on for a while. I'd go back to school, and I'd take 3 credits. My money run out, and I'd drop out, and I'd go to work again. And then I'd go back, and I'd take 3 more credits. And then my money run out, and I drop out again. All this time, I'm living in the projects. And so when I was finally able to graduate from University of Baltimore, you know, they told you to wear dark shoes and a dark dress on your gown. I bought the brightest red shoes I could find.
Okay.
And when I walked through, I wanted everybody to know that I am finally here.
All right.
You know, the graduate degrees were easy. You know, I went on and got a graduate degree from Coppin State, Johns Hopkins University. But that first step, that was the hardest. As soon as I got over those 18 years, you know, I said, well, if I can do that, I can do anything.
Wow.
What an awesome story. Yes.
Wow.
What an awesome story. Wow.
And then, you know, in my book I talk about, you know, where I had to, it wasn't just fighting him, it was also fighting my husband because he hadn't graduated from high school. And so he couldn't understand why I kept pursuing this college. And so he tore up my books, you know, and I, you know, I said, look, I'm going to graduate from college if I have to graduate without you. And when he saw that there was nothing on this earth that could stop me,
At this time, can you go back to And Still I Cry? You just opened the door.
That was my first book. And I started that book. It was started out as a high school graduation present for my daughter. Then it turned into a birthday present and then another graduation. And that went on for almost 20 years. Because the pain of reliving the pain that I went through as a child, you know, the abuse. I was homeless at 16. And I was homeless because I tried to cut my stepfather when he was beating my mother. And and then they put me out, you know, and I slept on the floor with my aunt and you know, and I talk about all of those, that pain of growing up. That's why I was so good at, you know, I got A's through school because I would leave home in the morning to go to school, and I used to fix my breakfast over a Bunsen burner. I can remember now eating canned peaches in my chemistry class because going there, I would stay there, be trying to get away because my mother was going to work, and I didn't want to be in the house with my stepfather because he would abuse me. And I would stay at school late in the evening, studying in the library there or just doing whatever I could do not to go home, because if I got there before she did, he would abuse me. And then I talk about coming in if she wasn't there. I would look to see if his car was there. This man was a military police in the Army and went to church every Sunday and sat on the front row.
Oh, my goodness.
But he was abusing me. You know, I'm afraid to go to sleep at night because he'd come into my bedroom, the room that I shared with my sister. And I talk about hiding in the closet, you know, and all of that stuff. So that, and Still I Cry talks about all of that, the things that people use as excuses for not succeeding. And
Can I get you to stop right here? Because you just made another momentous thing about people not wanting to move forward because of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
We are in a situation in our times now. Dr. Ford came forward and she shared something. Do you know? You know how hard it is to open up to tell somebody about the realities. And hers was mild. Hers was mild. I can imagine, because I've lived, what kind of things you would have to deal with to open up, to open your body up like you open up a can of sardines. I mean, it was jagged.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and everything that's in there.
I was so glad that somebody, that she actually opened up. You know, because I can go back and talk about being raped at gunpoint and was afraid to say anything because this guy said if I would tell my husband and my husband came and confronted him, he was going to kill him. And he would have done that, too, because he eventually killed his girlfriend while the son sat there and watched him shoot her. You know, and I can talk about things that happened during that time at one of the two of the places where I worked, you know, and I left there because of that, you know, because of all of that stuff you in my book, you know, of being sexually approached and fondled and even at Morgan.
I want you to know that there are so many women.
Yes, Lord.
Who carry that stigma.
Yes,
and
Lord.
Although they're talking about military PTSD or whatever, there are women walking around here.
That's right.
With the same symptoms.
That's
symptoms
right.
That cause you to have mental, physical, and emotional trauma because of what has happened in life.
That's true.
And nobody really wants to deal with it or acknowledge it. And how are we going to deal with this stigma when we heard it? You don't want me to say that part either on this show, right?
But you are absolutely
but
right.
Let me clarify that just one more minute. There was a time when I read, like, people drink water. And I remember reading, I read so much, I didn't always remember the book to have a reference to it. But I remember reading, and I tell some people this, that the United States Constitution is strong, and we can document this. The Constitution is strong, but it will fall from within. Period. When we have malice, deceit, robbery, and every other negative connotation to move forward with what the Bible says, that the love of money.
That's right.
When money is so important that you will lose your soul for it, that you will excel to the highest degree, and that you would do anything wrong to move where you want to be. And, yes, I'm putting a period behind that one.
That's right. That's right. You're absolutely right.
And this is what our young people are inheriting, a lifestyle that they have never even imagined. How are they going to maneuver this?
That's true.
It's going to take a lot of people like you and I and Joseph to help them to move through this, because they're going to have to learn how to build some self-esteem, self-reliance, and some of these things that will be a self other than yourself. Well, yes, self-appreciation, and also to understand that life is not just a picnic. It's something that you have to live.
That's true. That's true. You know, and I say so often, we only go around once in life, and this is not a practice run.
No, it is not.
This is the real thing the first time around. And if we don't make good at it, we don't get a second chance.
Well, Senator Robinson, you touched me and caused me to really reflect back up on my childhood, and I'm the only child, and I found out at the age of 17, really, that even though you suppress those feelings of abuse or having grew up in a home. In your book, Still I Cry, that what went on that previous program, and I grew up in a abusive household where my father, even though he was a functioning alcoholic, but you know the old story, the black men, after they get off from work on Friday, they go to the liquor store and they buy liquor. And my father had a running liquor account. And every weekend, my mother worked as a waitress. He was extremely jealous. And Senator Robinson, to this day, I still can hear my mother crying and hearing my father hitting her with his fist and cursing at her. And we only had a 3-bedroom house, so you know how close that was.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the lifestyle that I grew up in Memphis. And finally, you know, having had that experience and not being able to defend my mother from such abuse. Matter of fact, he would meet her at the restaurant and at night. And one night, he was drunk, cursing at her, and he hit her and knocked her off of the sidewalk, and she cut a deep gash in one of her legs from a broken Coca-Cola bottle, and they had to have stitches. And, you know, when I went off to Arkansas State College, this was in 1957, And at a spring, during a spring break, not a spring break, but a Christmas break. And I came home, and my mother came, I'm 17 years old, and my mother came to the door with tears in her eyes. And I knew what had happened. And just seeing her, and it unleashed all of those deep suppressed feelings that I had to grow up with as a child. And do you know, I went in that kitchen, my father was drinking, and do you know, I found myself assaulting my father on the floor. And I still, I from that day forward, I said that I'm not going to be like my dad. I'm going to make something out of myself to make my mother proud, and if my father is proud, so be it. But I thought that I had suppressed those feelings, Senator Robinson, even up to the age of 17.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't forget those experiences,
no, you
do
don't.
You?
No, you don't. Because, you know, sometimes certain things will remind me. I can remember when my father cut my mother on her arm with a razor. And when I can remember standing there watching her flesh come apart almost like a knife going through hot butter. That's how deep he cut her on her arm. And I can remember screaming, well, listening to somebody scream, and the scream was so loud that it was giving me a headache until they turned and looked at me, and I put my hand up, and I realized I was the one that was screaming. And
yeah.
I had to see when I was in the ninth grade, I had these fainting spells, and that was because of my father my stepfather would beat my mother every weekend. And the neighbors knew, my school's classmates knew, because, you know, they'd pass by my house sometime and he's beating her. And as I said, my mother, he would only beat her when she was drunk. He wouldn't try her when she was sober. But she was drunk every weekend. And my mother wasn't the one that would come in the house and get drunk. When she was drunk, everybody in the neighborhood knew it, because she got out there and cursed everybody out and told about everybody's business, because we had a party line, telephone.
Yes,
three people
I remember
on
that.
There. Yeah, and it was ring one time for one person and two for another and three, but you could still hear. So I still remember those things. But not only that, you know, with this Me Too moment, there was a baby, and I just cannot leave this one alone. A 5-month-old baby was beaten to death by his father last year, and I'm still working on that one because I won't leave that alone. I can remember my stepfather.
Now I want to come in. This is the engineer from the booth. Excuse me. I'm sorry to cut in. Before this is a very, very rife conversation, and I just want to thank everyone for your participation. For the lack of timing, what I want to do is invite you, Senator Robinson, to come back for part two on Voices of Wisdom. If you could check your calendar, that would be November 1st. And what we would have you all do is to go around and give some final thoughts, because we do have people on the panel that have some appointments for this evening. But this has just been one of those conversations that you don't even want it to come to an end. So can we do a part two?
You know, November the 1st is my triplet's birthday.
Ooh.
But yeah,
okay.
I'm okay. I'm looking at my calendar now. I'm okay, and I would love to come back with Geraldine
oh, wow.
and Joseph.
Okay, well, I'm going to step back now. This is a very rife conversation, and I just want to be mindful of the engagements that we have ahead for the evening. And I would ask that you all go around. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis will lead you around for your final comments and closing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We are into this presentation and this conversation. And Joseph, you just shared something that we have not talked about. And so we are opening up doors. We're opening doors. And what we are trying to do here is to do what my purpose is, to enlighten. We want to enlighten people about what is happening, what has happened, and the possibilities of how we can help others to be at their very best. And so I know that I do have an outline, but hey, we are working just great on this. We have so many things that you, Senator Barbara Robinson, has not even touched on, but there is so much here that we have pulled out of this, and it's a ledge for us to move on, to move forward, to know that we can move from this ledge to get to the next level. Mm-hmm. And so I want to say now what we'll do is think about, in conclusion, where do we find ourselves in conclusion? And I'll just start here and say one of the things that I always want to do is to focus on my story, because my story is relevant. But why do I want to tell you about my experiences? Because if you know someone's experiences, you can see that you too have an opportunity to go past and beyond those experiences. And why do I want to share my thoughts anyway? Because I feel as though it is important. And what is the relevance of my story to history? If you don't know your history, you are destined to repeat it. Who am I, and why do I feel that I even have anything to add to the trillions of words already in print? Because there are always new people that need to read something. What have I contributed to society? The fact that I am who I am, and I'm proud to be who I am, because I've gone through these challenges, and these challenges make me who I am. What have I, in my estimation, already contributed to society? I've contributed a lot, because I have helped someone else along the way. How have I helped anyone as I travel along this road to life? I have taught, I have complimented, I have lifted others up, I have encouraged others, and most of all, I have been a teacher, not of just the subject, but of life. Can I document what I've accomplished? That's why we write. Is my contribution to society measurable? Only if you know what you want to be measured. And most of all, I want everyone to know, who am I? And I have to know that for myself. So I always say, I'm Geraldine Hollis. And I want all people to know that I'm a person who has put my life on the line to make a difference for the lives of others.
Well said.
So
well
in
said.
Conclusion, Joseph,
yes.
would you... I guess maybe I should say, would you like to let Senator Robinson go next, and then you can really be able to move and share your...
Yes, Geraldine, because what I heard from Senator Robinson, I may not even be able to speak. Yeah, so let her go.
Okay.
I want to thank you both for allowing me into your life. And what do I have to contribute? You know, for a long time, I was actually ashamed of having written
my first book, because when I became a person that I am today, and people, young people, and people I've met along the way look up to, I didn't want them to know that part of my life. But I thank God for allowing me to accept who I am, because my past is a part of me, and I don't have to live in my past. I take from my past what I need in order to propel me in the future. Had I not lived, had I not been who I was, I couldn't be who I am today, because I feel as comfortable talking, you know, sitting down with the President of the United States and the governor and the mayor, who are friends of mine, as I do another friend of mine who works with homelessness, and I'm on the Commission for Homelessness, and sitting down with her on in a room feeding people who are hungry, and then not realizing or not caring what kind of clothes they have on or who they are or where they have an education or not, because it's not about politics and power. It's about people and progress. And that's what I said when I first went to Annapolis, when I first joined this thing called politics. And I tell people, I'm not a politician. I'm a servant, a public servant. And when I look at people and I want them to get from me that your condition does not have to be your conclusion. You can be whoever you want to be as long as you realize that you cannot allow anyone to define your limitations, and you never, ever sell yourself short. So if someone can take away from anything that I've done in life, I want them to take away the fact that I am who I am, because that's who God wanted me to be. And if you don't like who I am, that is your problem.
All right. Well said. Well said. Joseph?
Yes. And I know Senator Robinson and I are truly on the same page, because when I asked her why did she go to Africa, what motivated her or inspired her to go to Africa, and she mentioned one word that I was able to connect with, and she said, you know, I went there as a missionary. You know, my church was always a part of me. And then when she mentioned a church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Well, that's where the first AME church was founded there in Charlotte, South Carolina, I believe, and it was called Mother Emanuel. Is that right, Senator? And so when she mentioned, you know, she went there as a missionary, and I spent 30 years as a deputy probation officer serving the public, especially the young people. I was in the juvenile delinquency intake department. And I went there not actually as a probation officer or to earn a great deal of money, but God sent me there to minister to all of those that was brought to me, and I had to make a decision as to whether to incarcerate them or release them on house arrest or just to just release them outright. And to me, that was a ministry. And when she and that's what I'm about, meeting people like Senator Robinson that continues to inspire me and to let me know why I'm here and what my purpose is. And I ask the universe every night to continue to use me and my son as its servants by serving others. That is what Joseph Jackson Jr. is about serving others and trying to make their burdens lighter.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely a wonderful in conclusion.
It's wonderful.
Wonderful. Yes. I would like to say that we are in conclusion. We're probably closing out a little bit early. I hope that someone who is on may not be a little bit disappointed, but we want to invite you back to our November 1st show. And we will move along this same line. And if anyone has any questions that you would like to have acknowledged, email me, or rather put them on Messenger in Facebook regarding this show. And let us know what is it that you would like to ask or make a comment on. We cannot always do this while we are speaking, because we are moving forward with our thoughts and what we would like to project out there. Because once we do Voices of Wisdom, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to be a platform that others can look at and listen to and know that they too can move forward in their lives. And if they know that there are people there to support them and words to encourage them and ideas to lead them forward, and the almighty majesty of the universe, as Joseph say, almighty God, that can direct them through one word, having faith.
That's right.
Because it is by faith that we moved, all three of us, through our life, through
right.
the challenge that we have had. And wisdom isn't something that you learn. Wisdom comes from experience.
That's true.
You can always, you can walk into a wall, but you don't know that it hurt until after you hit it.
That's true.
We are Voices of Wisdom. And right now, I would like for to say that we want to close out and let everyone know that this platform was done by Miss Daisy, I believe. I don't have the name in front of me. Beverly, you might have to come back on and let that be known. I've just gotten so filled up with all of the things, and I usually have everything ready to say. But we want to make sure that
well,
we let everyone know.
Oh, well, you are right. You are right on, spot on, Ms. Geraldine Hollis. This has been such a right program. I want to thank each and every one of you. And just like Mrs. Geraldine Hollis said, part two will continue right in that vein, because like she also reiterated that Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. had mentioned some things that we're first, you know, hearing for the first time. These are avenues and subject matters that are being opened by the content that you're covering. And Senator Barbara Robinson, we want to thank you so much for being so transparent about your life experiences and what you have gone through. We know that we are in a landscape of Me Too moments, and so we just really do appreciate that you would be that transparent and honest all around, all of you. This show is Voices of Wisdom is named so to keep the voice of Rachel Berry alive through our platform. She created the group Voices of Wisdom because everyone knows something that someone else needs to know.
That's
and
true.
She officially created the Vow Network on Facebook. So we always want to shout out, rest in peace to Rachel Berry, a.k.a. author Lady Serenity. We want to thank you, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, and Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. for being such a wonderful host. We will see you back November 1st. Thank you, Mrs. Senator Barbara A. Robinson. We want to definitely see you all back here November 1st. And by then, I think we should know what has happened with Professor Ford and this you know, judge that is up for the vote, and there should be a lot more to talk about as you continue to be a voice of wisdom and cover these moments. So, again, thank you all so very much, and you can listen to the archive show via blogtalkradio.com/gumbo for the soul. You can inbox Mrs. Geraldine Hollis for your questions or comments for her to bring to the platform next month. And you can also follow our parent company at gumbofortheSoulInternational.com. So God bless you all, and we will talk November the 1st.
Okay, good
Thank
night.
You, and good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealer's honking. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train. Tri-Family Channel, Tri-Family Channel.